Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to another episode of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Explainer podcast. My name is William Hild. I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. I'm excited to be joined today by two very interesting experts in the area of cyber and privacy technology. The first is Jennifer Huddleston, who's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center. And the second is Ashley Baker, Director of Public Policy at the Committee for Justice. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Well, the topic of today's discussion is some rather groundbreaking technology in the last decade or so, although it goes back farther than that, of biometrics. Before we get into the regulation of biometrics and the questions that raises, Jennifer, do you mind telling us what is biometrics?
So biometrics is a rather broad catch-all term that can apply to a lot of different technologies. Probably what's been in the news most when we hear about biometrics is facial recognition technology and the various uses of facial recognition technology or the potential uses of facial recognition technology. But it can also apply to various things like fingerprint scans, iris scans, DNA even. So really we're looking at kind of technology that uses an individual's identity to do different things.
Got it. How is it currently being regulated throughout the United States?
Well, what we've seen most action on when it comes to biometrics are at a state and local level. So what got a lot of news recently was San Francisco actually went so far as to ban government use of facial recognition by the city in general. But we've also seen broader state laws. So Texas, Washington, and Illinois all have state laws regulating biometric information privacy. The Illinois law particularly has had several court cases about private rights of action and about how far this law extends. And as a result, actually, we've seen some cases where certain technology hasn't been available to residents of Illinois. So I don't know if anyone remembers, but a couple of years ago, there was this Google Art selfie thing where you took a picture and you ran it through a system and it showed you who your like art twin was and what that museum that was in. And because of the law regulating biometrics in Illinois, that wasn't available to Illinois residents.
And I would add that the law in Illinois was actually passed about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago. So the technology has definitely evolved since then, and it's being applied to a lot of other cases. The penalty for it is between $1 and $5,000 per violation. And that's per potential violation. That's not, there doesn't necessarily have to be a violation or harm, just one instance of not complying with the law.
Wow. Well, you know, as this technology develops, what are the things that society should be concerned with as we think about regulating biometrics? Obviously, there's a privacy concern there for citizens and individuals, but there's obviously a lot of potential pros and cons to a lot of different regulatory schemes. What are the key factors people should be considering?
Well, certain forms of biometric identification, such as facial recognition, shouldn't be allowed to be used on its own to establish probable cause. That is one thing. There's also real-time surveillance of specific individuals. That's one thing that would be concerning. But overall, the public conversation has been more focused on the big tech companies and what they're using it for. And I think that's a mistake, because if those companies are allowed to at least develop the technology a bit, then we have a more accurate system for when law enforcement does use it.
And I think it's important to point out there's also a lot of potential benefits of this technology, everything from being able to help locate missing children in a department store to being able to open your front door without your key when your hands are full trying to bring in groceries after a long day.
To unlock your iPhone, too.
To unlock your iPhone or any number of uses that we've already seen start to emerge, let alone what could potentially be used. So it's important when we're discussing this not only to think about those potential harms and the potential harmful uses, but to also address the potential beneficial uses, in the sense of we want to make sure that when we're examining these technologies that we aren't always just looking at the worst case scenarios, and that we're really focusing on those harms and trying to directly address those rather than focusing on the technology as just bad in general when it does potentially have a lot of beneficial uses.
And I think we also need to focus on what is harm. And that's a common theme throughout privacy law and also antitrust is, particularly when we don't define harm, such as in the Illinois Biometric Act, that is not well defined. And individuals have standing to sue, which is a huge problem and plaintiffs' attorneys take advantage of that system.
And I think it also, with that one, there's been a really interesting case recently involving Six Flags. You wouldn't think of an amusement park as a place where a lot of biometric information is collected, but one can, again, really see the trade-offs there in this case of they were using, I believe it's fingerprints, to validate annual passes. And so that way they could make sure that if I have an annual pass, I don't just give it to Ashley and she goes to the park and claims that she's Jennifer. But because of the nature of this law and because the plaintiff in this particular case was under the age of 18 at the time he picked up his seasonal pass, there was, even though there wasn't that kind of traditional harm we would think of, the law was in such a way that they were able to bring that suit.
Yeah, and there was no harm there. He went home, I believe, and told his mother that they took his fingerprints. Maybe a few weeks or so later, an attorney talked to the mother, and then because there was an infraction, all there has to be is that infraction. There does not have to be harm demonstrated.
Under the Illinois
yes.
law. Well, switching just quickly to the California, it sounds like they banned the entire technology in San Francisco. Versus the use of it in a certain form. Talk a little bit about that, Jennifer, as far as, because different jurisdictions have come at it different ways as far as banning the tech versus banning using it a certain way. And sort of, is there a benefit of one approach versus another?
Because this is going to be a messy answer to begin with, so feel free to jump in. So I don't necessarily remember all the details of the San Francisco law off the top of my head, but there are a couple of unique things. First off, it was directly targeting government use, which is good in some ways because it does allow this private government distinction. I think some of the questions is, while a lot of the concerns about harm from this technology concern potential civil liberties abuses of what could be done in terms of profiling of how this could be used for real-time surveillance, the problem is there are also beneficial uses to law enforcement and other government officials as well. And so there's kind of this question of, are there adequate remedies that allow at least an exception when there is a beneficial use? One could easily see, you know, just a broad ban preventing things like using certain security camera footage or being able to rapidly run through existing files or something like that. And so it's a lot of this really is about where are those lines being set and how can we ensure that we do have the beneficial uses while limiting those potential legitimate concerns about the abuses that could occur with over-government use of this.
Right, and with corporations, it doesn't make much sense to be more concerned about them than the government, I mean, just as a general matter, but it depends on, you know, how the government can access the data that the corporations have, which is, you know, a completely different area of law under the Fourth Amendment. So I think there's not enough focus, there's not enough people paying attention to that, you know, with corporations and with identifying your face for corporate purposes, then, I mean, they can't throw you in jail. The government can. So there's a huge distinction there. And there are ways in which the government could have made us safer through facial recognition. One great example is the Boston bomber, the Boston Marathon, could have been identified much more quickly.
And I think to that public-private distinction, again, of you can opt out of working with a certain corporation, you can opt out of purchasing certain products or on an individual level. It's much more difficult, if not impossible, to opt out of government access to this information. I think that's why oftentimes this whole conversation gets unfortunately merged together to one issue when really there are several distinct elements that need to be discussed separately and will have separate legal and policy solutions.
And government surveillance, I mean, you don't know when it's happening unless the infrastructure is there. I mean, you know, you had in China recently tearing down the tower, I believe, that identified people's faces, and you can see it there, and you can see, you know, we can see cell phone towers, and there's something, you know, about facial recognition that makes people particularly paranoid and that you can't see that it's going on. But, you know, these types of surveillance have happened, you know, for quite a while.
Got it. Well, what areas of this have I not asked about that I should have asked about? What are some of the concerns?
One concern I would bring up is racial bias in facial recognition. There are concerns that facial recognition does not do as good of a job recognizing people of color, certain nationalities. That is true to some extent. That's based on the training data. It's not, you know, tested as much on that, on, you know, certain races. And it should, you know, that's something that gets better as time. You give the algorithm more data, you test it more, and that allows the technology to develop. So in order to, you know, overcome that, that's why we need more testing and use of it by, you know, researchers, by corporations.
And I think just kind of picking up on that last element that Ashley mentioned of, I think we need to distinguish in some ways our concerns about what surveillance could look like on a government scale and about the potential implications of this for law enforcement. And like I said earlier, also to recognize that there are times when this technology could be beneficial and could be used in an appropriate way by law enforcement. We want to make sure those guardrails are on there to protect civil liberty and in line with the Fourth Amendment, so that individuals know what their rights are. On the other hand, there also are a lot of wonderful uses in the consumer marketplace, in workplaces of this, that I think a lot of times we just focus on those really scary dystopian, we're all living in Minority Report scenarios, and don't focus enough on the fact that you now can unlock your iPhone with your face.
Yeah, and it's important to remember sometimes the mistakes that humans can make are a lot more dangerous than the mistakes that technology can make. I think it's about 70% of wrongful convictions happen because of mistaken eyewitness. So that's one example of where you know, facial recognition could actually be beneficial.
Interesting. So in other words, a better way to ID a suspect may be with facial recognition rather than eyewitness.
Well, like I said, it shouldn't be used to establish probable cause, but it could be used to determine if the eyewitness is incorrect.
Incredible. Got it. Well, at the you mentioned two state and local based attempts to regulate it. Is there any movement at the federal level or at the agency level to put in place rules around the use of biometric technology?
There have been various bills proposed, but as far as I'm aware, nothing's really gotten significant momentum at this point.
Not yet. I mean, there is a lot of talk over whether or not it will make its way into a federal privacy bill in the next term or so, whether there will be a biometrics clause, but we don't really know that yet.
And are there any concerns specific to other types of biometrics? You mentioned at the beginning there's fingerprinting, iris scanning. We've talked a lot about facial recognition, but is there any other areas of biometrics and concerns that you might have or possible benefits, obviously, with different types?
I think these all end up a lot of times getting lumped together into the same conversation. I know that on a state level, we have started to see some proposals specifically on genetic information kind of separately.
And there's even different types of facial recognition.
Right, exactly. Right? So, yeah.
And yeah, there are different types of facial recognition. There's a difference between being able to recognize that there is a face, that there is a human there, being able to recognize and being able to recognize specifically who it is. And so there are distinctions within that, and they kind of get lumped together. I think, you know, there are various levels of potential harm there, too.
And just like that, there's also various levels of when and how this technology is deployed, whether it's real time, which I think is where a lot of people have the concerns of when it comes to government surveillance type of issues, or any kind of surveillance issues. But there's also kind of an after the fact, the ability to kind of match an individual to a database type of thing.
And that's why I think people are particularly concerned about aerial surveillance, because that is real time. You had the situation in Baltimore, I believe a year or so ago. Right? I don't remember.
Yeah, it was definitely, it was something around there. Yeah, yeah. A couple of years. I don't know how when it started and then when.
I don't remember when it started and when it ended. Mm-hmm. But, you know, aerial surveillance and particularly drones, people are concerned about, because that does take, you know, tracking in real time.
Yeah, that sounds like one of the big issues here is the intersection with other types of technology. You add in, you take the biometrics, and then you add in drones, and now you could potentially cover, you know, very, very quickly an entire, you know, city with surveillance in a way that wouldn't necessarily have been possible 10, 20 years ago, which I'm sure is a big part of what's raising people's ire about the technology.
And that brings up different constitutional issues, too. For example, or, you know, with a drone, are they surveilling you on your own property or in public? There are a lot of questions to consider there.
As I say, I think that, again, given that this is a short one, doing just a very base level of, I'm hearing scary things.
Right. Are the drones coming for me?
Are the drones the police using this and being able to kind of set those limits on... Yes, it's good if you're paying attention, but don't just pay attention to the dystopian scenario.
Right, right.
Let's also talk about potential benefits. Let's talk about, you know, what this means in terms of good abilities in personal life. One thing we didn't mention, you know, when you think about, say, the disabled community, and again, with somebody who has limited mobility and is able to use facial recognition to interact with certain devices may end up being able to have, you know, a more independent life or things like that. You know, we mentioned finding the child in the department store seems to be a go-to example. But one way that this is currently being used, and I think there is some controversy, is in boarding airplanes. But you can much more quickly board an airplane when everyone doesn't have to have out that boarding pass and scan through, and then somebody's fumbling with their phone and whatnot. When you can just walk onto an international flight and they know who's on that flight, and it, you know, there are people who are concerned about that, and there are opt-out options for those people, but for a lot of people, they might be willing to do that. We've seen, again, there's a program called Clear at a lot of airports and also at things like NFL stadiums that gets you through security faster based off of biometric readings. And so I think as this technology, if we let this technology evolve, if we don't let our fears just immediately lead to kind of a privacy panic or a techno panic over it, there are a lot of beneficial uses as well. And we certainly should consider how we already are experiencing this in everyday life and what we like about that, as well as, you know, really having, if necessary, a conversation about what, if any, policy or legal restraints do we need to have for those Fourth Amendment protections?
And I think another thing that we need to learn from this debate is to contextualize it in the sense of the debate we're having right now over federal privacy legislation and learn, you know, from the example of Illinois, for example, what we need to stay away from and not need to do, such as the harms of having a private right of action, how that has played out and really only benefited the plaintiff's attorneys, how we really need federal preemption if there's a bill. I think there are a lot of takeaways here.
I mean, another example of how a lot of us use this in everyday life that we might not realize is photo tagging. When you recognize a photo, it's become very easy to identify who's in that. It's, like I said, I think we really want to have that conversation about, are there harms that need to be addressed and limits that need to be established, but also what would we be giving up in the process of potentially establishing those limits? Because at the end of the day, any kind of regulation, particularly of private use, is going to involve trade-offs, and it's going to involve trade-offs with speech in the form of different elements of communication. It's going to involve trade-offs with privacy, and so the idea that something can just have a completely neutral effect isn't necessarily going to be true.
And no one really thinks of photo tagging as biometrics, but now the Ninth Circuit does.
Yeah.
And they say that, you know, individuals have standing. And that's not because the individuals were outraged because they realized they were suffering some sort of harm because of this biometric form of identification. This was plaintiff's attorneys who established standing in the Ninth Circuit, and that's particularly dangerous.
So it will be an interesting time to watch, and it's certainly going to be an evolving issue for people to watch over the next couple of years in congruence with the privacy conversation, but also on its own as we start to see these kind of separate actions specifically related to this technology.
Jennifer and Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today on this podcast. We'll definitely have to have you guys back on as this issue develops.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.